Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
We're getting people ready now. What we call a warning order has gone out to my forces, and we will be ready to go.
A new storm is forecast to bring high winds and flooding to Alaska's northwest coast. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, October 5th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, many homeless campers in Anchorage don't want to go to a city-run shelter.
It's horrible. The conditions are horrible. The area becomes terrible. It's just not safe.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
NEA Alaska is a professional education association representing over 11,000 of Alaska's dedicated public school employees. Their members are united in their commitment to provide an excellent education for every student, regardless of background or zip code. Together, NEA Alaska members work with colleagues, parents, and their communities to build strong public schools that are productive, safe, and welcoming to all. Learn more at NEAAlaska.org. This message sponsored by NEA Alaska.
A storm is forecast to hit Alaska's northwest coast with high winds and coastal flooding starting tonight and continuing into Friday. That's as many western Alaska communities are still trying to recover from last month's major storm, the remnants of Typhoon Murbach, which impacted nearly 1,000 miles of coastline. While the current storm's track appears to be farther north, National Weather Service meteorologist Ryan Metzger says the communities impacted by the previous storm are now more vulnerable than they were a month ago.
You know, the worst impacts was the storm way north of the Bering Strait, but areas south of the Bering Strait that were impacted by the previous storm, you know, they have more susceptibility to, you know, small, you know, lower events. So that's kind of where we're keeping an eye out for those areas.
The most serious impacts are expected from Shishmaref to Kotzebue and up the coast to Utqiagvik. The Weather Service has issued warnings for high winds, flooding, or both for those areas, as well as the community of Gamble on St. Lawrence Island in the Bering Sea. Wind gusts are expected as high as 70 miles per hour in some locations by Thursday. To the south, in places like Nome, Unalakleet, and down to Hooper Bay, there are less serious weather advisories in effect. State officials say assessment resources and local contractors are already on hand in communities that might be affected by the coming storm. The Alaska National Guard's Adjutant General, Major General Torrance Sachs, says guardsmen and helicopters are pre-positioned at armories in Nome, Kotzebue, and Utqiagvik.
This could be a different storm, as we've heard, so we are getting people ready now. What we call a warning order has gone out to my forces, and we will be ready to go.
Governor Mike Dunleavy urged residents in the region to prepare. He emphasized the importance of protecting human life after no deaths or serious injuries were reported from last month's storm. Most locations within the National Weather Service's warning zone are expected to see the high wind tapering off by Friday. The Kodiak fishery debate concluded last night with forums for U.S. House and Senate, and the four House candidates agreed on a lot. Their views differed, though, on a House bill to reauthorize the Magnuson-Stevens Act, the primary law that governs fishing in federal waters. Congresswoman Mary Peltola was the only candidate to support it. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin reports.
Republican House candidate Nick Begich is against the bill and skeptical of a provision in it that would add 2 Alaska tribal seats to the North Pacific Fishery Management Council.
I'm encouraged to see their Alaskan seats. But nevertheless, you know, I sort of question that decision to so radically change the composition of the council.
Libertarian Chris Bai, a fishing guide from Fairbanks, says he likes the idea of adding more seats for Alaskans, but
I would appreciate it if it was more interior focused and not necessarily based on a color of skin.
Former Republican Governor Sarah Palin says she doesn't know enough about the Magnuson-Stevens reauthorization bill to discuss it in the level of detail posed by the question.
When it comes to the inside baseball specifics of all that you had just read there, in a debate, it's kind of difficult to say absolutely yes or no, whether you would support something or not. When you have it in front of you, you know, you don't know the context. You can't read all of it.
Palin says she suspects the bill gives too much leeway to federal bureaucrats. Newly elected Congresswoman Mary Peltola, a Democrat, says she was proud to vote for the bill when it passed out of the House Resources Committee last month. She says the late Congressman Don Young also saw the need to add two Alaska Native seats to the North Pacific Council.
The council works well for the biggest, the wealthiest, and the most connected among us. But if you don't happen to be big and wealthy and connected, it is very hard to get any inroads in the council process.
The House candidates' forum was followed by a U.S. Senate candidate debate between Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski and her Democratic challenger, Pat Chesbrough. Chesbrough, a retired educator, says if she could change one law related to fishing, it would be to reduce the waste of bycatch when a species is caught that is not the target fish.
When I see that people are starving, I have really difficulty thinking that we would throw away food and it would just go to waste. And I would try to work on figuring out how we would not do that anymore.
Murkowski says she'd like to change the Marine Mammal Protection Act to consider limiting the populations of sea otters. Murkowski says they've grown too numerous in some areas and are wiping out crab and other marine resources.
It is something that Alaskans have come to me, that come to colleagues in the state legislature as well, seeking answers. It's a tough one, but I'd like to try to work through that one.
The Kodiak fishery debate has been a feature of Alaska election season for more than 30 years. Murkowski's Republican challenger, Kelly Chewbacca, skipped it. Her campaign said she had an unnamed scheduling conflict. Chewbacca was fundraising in Texas early this week. Reporting from Anchorage, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Dozens of homeless residents are still camping at Anchorage's Centennial Campground, even though the city officially closed the area on Saturday. Some say they don't want to stay at the reopened shelter at the Sullivan Arena for a variety of reasons, and they say they have nowhere else to go. As Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early reports, the city just gave the campers a final deadline to move out within 2 weeks.
Esteban Diaz has been staying at Centennial Campground for several months after Anchorage Mayor Dave Bronson closed the Sullivan Arena shelter in late June and began waiving fees at the campsite. Even though the camp is officially closed, by Tuesday afternoon, Diaz was still among dozens of people still there. Several Anchorage police vehicles were parked at the gate with officers walking around and meeting with Diaz and others who gathered around their tents.
I was just here putting my stuff up and several people came over, police officers, gave me eviction notice.
The paper Diaz was given was originally a 10-day notice to leave, but officers crossed out the 10 and wrote in a 15. The notice was dated October 4th. Tuesday. Campers across the site were given similar forms. Camp abatement notices were also stapled on many trees in the campground. A few campsites down, Jeffrey Butler said he knew for most of September that the camp was going to close, but he wasn't sure what alternative there would be.
For almost a couple weeks now, there's been a sign on this whiteboard that said we pretty much have 30 days to go, but they didn't tell us where we're going until just recently.
Mayor Bronson confirmed he'd reopen the Sullivan Arena shelter only 2 days before Centennial closed. The city had buses to move people to the shelter on Saturday, but Butler says he doesn't want to go there.
Now that they picked Sullivan again, I know that me and the people around us, we don't want to go to Sullivan because it's a bunch of hassle there.
Butler's tent was among dozens still set up at the campground. Many are spread out by each individual campsite with tarps thrown over for protection from a rain-heavy August and September. Water and power were still on Tuesday afternoon, though the city had warned about shutting them off. The bathrooms were also still opened. Butler isn't the only camper who doesn't plan on going to the Sullivan. Eric Anderson says he'd been camping at Centennial for about a month before the Sullivan closed. He says he noticed a change at Centennial once the mayor started directing people from the Sullivan to the camp.
I could see for a lot of people it became unsafe, you know, being an adult male and having all my faculties, it wasn't, you know,
it wasn't dangerous for me, but for a lot of people it was, and staff just didn't do anything.
City Health Department spokesman Tyler Sachtobin says the 15-day eviction notice also includes an extra day for people to leave the campground. That means the deadline is October 20th. Diaz said he's reluctantly going to head to the Sullivan Arena before his eviction date.
I mean, I'm going to the Sullivan, but I don't want to be so much dependent on Sullivan Arena. It's too crowded, too many people, and I don't like that. People steal a lot, anything you leave around.
Anderson doesn't think Sullivan was managed well and thinks it's had a negative impact on the area.
Everybody in the community knows that's a farce. That is terrible down there. It's dangerous. It's horrible. The conditions are horrible. The area becomes terrible. It's just not safe.
He said he may park his vehicle out in the woods to camp. He doesn't know of anywhere else to go indoors except the Sullivan. For Butler, he's concerned about what seems like city officials' singular focus on housing. He thinks the city needs a variety of facilities to address people who are homeless.
They're blanketing it like, oh, everybody just needs housing. And it's not it. Like, there's people here with mental health disorders. There's people here with drug problems. There's people here with ID problems. There's a whole bunch of different things that are going on.
For weeks, Butler has had little success finding more permanent housing, but he says he's still looking. In Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Bethel residents vote against letting stores sell beer and wine.
For the safety of all and for the well-being of the community, I voted no on that.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Sneezing, aching, sweating, and coughing. Who has the time for this misery? You have the power to protect yourself and your community. Boost your defenses this season by getting the flu vaccine, and make sure to have an updated COVID-19 booster. Help keep your friends and family protected and healthy this winter. Learn more at vaccinate.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
There were municipal elections in many Alaska communities Tuesday, and the biggest winners in Sitka's election weren't candidates, but ballot propositions for a new tax on marijuana to support school activities and for withdrawing $8 million from the city's permanent fund to build a marine haulout and boatyard. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Prop 1 asked voters to replace the regular 6% sales tax on marijuana products with an 8% tax dedicated to support extracurricular activities in Sitka schools. Voters approved of the measure 57-43%. Outgoing Assemblymember Kevin Knox is one of the ballot proposition's sponsors. He sees the vote as a win that's been in the making since the state legalized cannabis in 2015.
Marijuana Advisory Committee talked about this quite extensively. It's been debated and discussed in the community for quite some time.
The tax is projected to eventually raise up to $300,000. Knox says it will now be up to the school board to determine how to apply it.
To enhance activities and be able to provide additional reach for kids that and families that can't necessarily afford participating in activities at all or, you know, multiple activities.
The other ballot question to pass was Prop 2, which asked voters to take up to $8 million from the recent sale of the Sitka Community Hospital building and apply it toward the construction of a public marine haulout and boatyard. Voters passed the proposition by a staggering margin, with 80% in favor. Over 800 absentee and early ballots have yet to be counted in this year's municipal election in Sitka, but it's unlikely that the results would flip the large approval margin voters gave Props 1 and 2 on Election Day. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
In Bethel, voters chose to keep alcohol laws in the city as they are and to prohibit the city from enacting future mask mandates. KYUK's Nina Kravinsky reports.
A question posed to voters on yesterday's ballot asked whether or not businesses should be able to open stores selling beer and wine. Currently, beer and wine are only allowed at permitted restaurants, and voters decided it should stay that way. That ballot measure is what drove Nick Thompson to the Cultural Center to vote yesterday. He voted with the majority. More than twice as many people voted to keep alcohol laws as they are, rather than allow a beer and wine store.
Alcohol has destroyed a lot of families, continues to do so, and we don't need more of it.
Ida Alexi, also voted against the measure. Families were also on her mind when she cast her ballot.
I think of all the kids that get forgotten when there's a alcohol package store. So for the safety of all and for the well-being of the community, I voted no on that.
John Wallace agrees that hard liquor should remain banned in Bethel. But he voted yes to a store selling just beer and wine, which was the proposal on the ballot.
I don't see a problem with people being able to go to pick up a six-pack of beer or a bottle of wine. It's a totally different thing.
The other question to voters on the ballot had to do with masks. Voters seem to have decided by a slim majority to amend the city code to prevent Bethel from enacting mask mandates. The ballot proposition passed in last night's unofficial results by only 26 votes. The city canvas board still has to verify 46 absentee and question ballots. Barbara Liu voted to prohibit the city from enacting a mask mandate.
It should be a personal choice.
She was thinking back to previous times the city council mandated masks in public when she cast her ballot.
There were a lot of people that were not happy last year or 2 years back. So make people happy.
Brian Neneman voted for the city to keep the ability to enact a mask mandate.
If it means an added measure of safety for the community during a pandemic, then yeah.
Voter turnout was up slightly from last year's city election, 15% compared to last year's 11%. In Bethel, I'm Nina Krivinsky.
And in Ketchikan, a proposition to remove borough funding for the Ketchikan Public Library is narrowly failing in early results. Nearly 55% of borough voters outside city limits voted against the proposition. Voter turnout across Ketchikan was 31%, which was substantially higher than the 20% figure reported last year. Turnout was especially high in areas outside city limits where voters were asked to vote on the library funding. There are nearly 300 absentee, questioned, and special needs ballots outside city limits still to be counted, so it remains to be seen whether the 159-vote margin from the election night will hold.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Westmark Fairbanks Hotel and Conference Center, overlooking the Chena River in downtown Fairbanks, with 400 guest rooms and 17,000 square feet of meeting space. Reservations at westmarkhotels.com. If you are a hunter, birder, or outdoor enthusiast, the U.S. Geological Survey is asking for help tracking the bird populations in Alaska. The USGS manages a nationwide bird banding program, and every year, thousands of birds are marked with small, numbered leg bands. If you see, find, or harvest a banded bird, please report the band number online at reportband.gov. The information provided will help inform how bird populations may be changing. This message sponsored by the USGS Alaska Science Center.
Students, parents, and alumni asked the Anchorage School Board to keep funding for language immersion programs at a packed meeting last night. The district faces a budget gap of at least $68 million next year and has sought input from families on potential cuts. At last night's meeting, multiple parents said losing their child's language immersion program could prompt them to leave Anchorage. Maria Horn Rollins has a fourth grader at Government Hill Elementary, which hosts one of two Spanish immersion programs in the district. She says her daughter's bilingual education was important to their whole family.
At a time when being Mexican continues to be a liability in this country, the Spanish immersion program at Government Hill is reinforcing Nola's pride in her Mexican heritage and her love for the Spanish language.
Zoe Parrish is a fifth grader at Government Hill. She introduced herself in Spanish and said she enjoyed the added challenge of studying history and science in Spanish.
I know that you're in the difficult position to cut funds for our schools, but I ask you, please don't deprive other kids of learning a new language.
The district runs 8 language immersion programs. District leaders are considering a range of cuts, including shrinking its virtual learning program and reducing planning periods for middle school teachers. The board plans to discuss potential school closures at its next meeting on Tuesday, October 18th. St. Paul Preschool at the Lutheran Church in Kodiak is closing, adding to the shortage of childcare options on the island. KMXD's Kirsten Dobrath reports administrators say they can't find a new director to keep the school open.
Parents were given letters late last week that said the last day of school for preschoolers at St. Paul Preschool is October 31st. Savannah Sella is the preschool's interim director. She says the decision to close is devastating.
It's hard to be the one to hand that letter out. Sorry, I'm going to get, to be the one to hand that letter out and just see the stress and the pain. And I want nothing more than to help these families. But unfortunately, we kind of just hit a dead end.
The preschool has been trying to hire a new director since August, when the former director took another job with the school district. Sella says parents were notified a few weeks ago that the preschool could close if that position wasn't filled. As of last week, no one had even applied for the job. 19 children go to St. Paul Preschool. Sella says St. Paul's program is one of the few childcare options in Kodiak for kids as young as 2 years old. The school already had to make programming cuts over the summer because of staffing shortages. Sella says finding new childcare options in Kodiak right now is difficult.
I know some people have already started getting on a wait list. There's really nothing open.
Sella says 8 part-time staff will also be losing their jobs with the preschool's closure. Some of them have started looking into opening a licensed in-home daycare, according to Sella, but there currently aren't any plans to open one anytime soon. In the meantime, Sella says St. Paul Preschool will continue its search for a new director, and they hope to reopen at a future date. In Kodiak, I'm Kirsten Dobrath.
After more than a decade of planning and work, the first memorial plaques have been placed at Wrangell's Mariners Memorial. KSTK's Sage Smiley attended the ribbon cutting and has this report.
As the evening light fades across the water, a crowd has gathered below the curved ship-like walls and lighthouse gazebo of Wrangell's Mariners Memorial.
Memorial spaces offer a place to grieve, heal, and celebrate. That's what we're here to do today.
Memorial Board President Jen Miller Yancey stands behind a red ribbon stretched across the memorial's walkway.
We are honored to present Wrangell Mariners Memorial as a place of remembrance and retelling of our stories for generations to come.
The road to the ribbon-cutting ceremony has been long. It's stretched over decades, tens of thousands of dollars in community fundraising, and several high school senior projects. Miller Yancey says it's a true community endeavor. Locals donated time, money, and expertise. The local government funded the design and provided a nominal lease on the land. 43 plaques were placed on the steel walls of the memorial in early September. Some have an anchor indicating a mariner that died at sea. Others simply remember mariners who spent their lives in, on, and around the water. Board member Gig Decker emphasizes the value of having a place to grieve, both personally and as a community. Decker's two children, Sig and Helen, died in a car accident a few years ago on Mitkoff Island. They were on break from commercial seining that summer. Their memorial plaques sit next to each other on one of the walls.
Being able to remember the people in our lives that have been important, that have had a big part of the sea, and allowing that to come forward and to help create the fabric of the history of our little community is really, really very, very important.
John Martin, also a memorial board member, agrees.
My brother Sid has his place on the wall. My father Sid has his place on the wall. And my stepfather Gunnar has his place on the wall. So as they say in the old country, Gunnar's cheese, Gunnar's cheese, Gunnar's cheese, ho ho.
The 43 names memorialized in the first round of plaques will be read out at next year's Blessing of the Fleet. Wrangell Music students and music teacher Tasha Morse perform Amazing Grace in honor of those names. As they sing, a hole breaks through in the gray clouds, unveiling an orange sunset. Borough Manager Jeff Good says every aspect of life in Wrangell is touched by the sea that surrounds the island.
And at its core, Wrangell is and always has been a fishing community, and the water is our lifeline.
Juneau-based landscape architect Christopher Myrtle designed the memorial. He and board member Brennan Eagle, who's been with the project for a decade, hold up a giant pair of scissors together.
Okay, it's officially open.
Community members rush up the incline of the memorial to examine the new plaques, eat refreshments, and admire the memorial in the last of the day's sun, the glowing point at the end of the harbor, a tangible place to feel grief, to remember loved ones, and to wish beloved mariners still sailing the seas safe passage at the start of each fishing season. In Wrangell, I'm Sage Smiley.
Wildlife officials in Metlakatla continue to trap record-setting numbers of the invasive crab species that threaten local subsistence food sources and fish habitat. As KRBD's Reagan Miller reports, the tribe's Department of Fish and Wildlife has trapped hundreds of European green crabs, but the numbers keep growing.
Months after the first green crab shell was found on the beach in Metlakatla, the community is still trying to figure out how to handle the arrival of a species that officials call one of the most invasive around. They're known to destroy fish habitat, eat other shellfish, and compete for vital resources. Destin Winter directs the tribe's Department of Fish and Wildlife. He says his department is doing all it can to keep up as the numbers soar, and as of now, that means trapping as much as possible.
We're going to try to keep those traps in the water in Tamgus Harbor and in other locations as we monitor those areas too, but short-term goals is just keep the traps in the water in Tamgus.
But so far, that hasn't seemed to put a dent in the population. Officials trapped a record 62 crabs on October 4th. That's a record for a single-day haul that broke the standing record of 38, set just the day before. And wildlife monitors found another 55 the day after, according to Metlakatla's mayor. Winter says Tamgus Harbor has turned into a hotspot for the crabs.
Well, it's pretty concerning for us. I mean, we were going from single digits to, you know, we had a record of 11 last week and then 13 at the end of the week. And then this week we've got, you know, a one-day catch of 38 and the next day of 62. So it's very concerning.
Wildlife officials have been setting shrimp pots to catch the crabs.
The juvenile crab that we're catching at the beginning were pretty small, so the shrimp pots are working really well.
When they're caught, wildlife officials collect biological information and freeze them. Once the crabs are dead, they're tossed into the compost pile at Metlakatla's community garden. Communities across the Pacific Northwest and the country have struggled to fight the spread of invasive green crabs. Most efforts have focused on trapping as many as possible. Washington Governor Jay Inslee declared an ongoing state of emergency in January because of the crab invasion across the state. Jay Scannell is a public information officer for Washington's Fish and Wildlife Department. He says the crabs have been around the state for more than 20 years, but they've recently spiked to concerning levels in the Puget Sound and Salish Sea.
We, at this point, have removed more than 170,000 European green crabs from Washington waters this year alone.
He says trapping is the only technique that Washington has used against the crabs. But he says he doesn't think wildlife authorities will be able to exterminate the species.
We know that they're here. We're not going to be able to remove all of them from our waters.
Further down the coast, wildlife officials are trying to make the crabs an attractive target for fishermen. In Oregon this summer, officials raised the recreational bag limit of the crabs to 35. That's to try and stop crabbers from throwing any green crabs they catch by accident back into the water to avoid fines. There are even a few recipes floating around Oregon's government website. And some have tried even more creative solutions. A distillery in New Hampshire is turning the creatures into crab-flavored whiskey. Officials are asking Alaskans in Metlakatla and elsewhere to keep an eye out for green crabs. European green crabs are the only species in Alaska that has three bumps between its eyes and five spines behind each eye. Anyone who spots European green crabs outside of Metlakatla is encouraged to call the invasive species hotline at 1-877-INVASIVE. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Reagan Miller.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Chris Clint, Liz Ruskin, and Wesley Early in Anchorage, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Nina Kravinsky in Bethel, Eric Stone and Reagan Miller in Ketchikan, Kirsten Dobrath in Kodiak, and Sage Smiley in Wrangell. Our audio engineer is Tobin Shelby, Katie Nastis is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil exploration and production and working to create economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
And by
Northern Air Cargo, providing cargo transportation to 9 Alaska communities. NAC offers options including cargo charters to get freight where it needs to be. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.